Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you all for coming along to our session this morning. This morning our session is on Australian fixed interest, and the topic is the credit crisis. Could we have known better? Our team of experts here this morning are going to talk to us about how conventional models of risk miss three key events that apparently occur with some consistency or have done so in the past. And the research paper asks whether we should have seen the 2007-2008 credit crisis coming. So I'd like you to please welcome today our researcher, Jeff Mitchell from Standard & Poor's, and our host, Cameron Dickman from Australian Unity, who will introduce our speaker.
First of all, obviously, thank you all for attending our session today. Look, I hope what we actually present to you today, I represent Australian Unity, and Australian Unity represents VNOVA Asset Management. And VNOVA Asset Management, for some of you who may or may not have seen, do think about fixed interest in a completely different way. Now, today, what we will hope we actually take you through is realistically the paper talks about philosophically where risks are and where risks have come from over the last number of years, and looks back historically at some very interesting facts. So I hope what we actually get through today is actually leading you down a discussion range of how differently to think about fixed interest, or possibly even how to think about fixed interest the way it was originally proposed to be fixed interest. Now, Claire Harding comes to us. Claire's been at Australian Unity now for about 6 months. Her background prior to that was with Russell as an asset consultant on the Russell side, and prior to that working with PIMCO. And Claire comes with a very strong fixed interest background, obviously, from her history there as well. So Claire Harding today will take us through some, I hope, some thought-provoking things, and we'll come back and take some questions on those thoughts at the end. Thank you, Claire.
King? Yes, okay. Thanks, Cameron. I'm going to introduce someone else who will talk on my behalf because I just think this introduction thing is fun. sorry. We're talking about risk uncertainty in the credit crisis. That's up there. And what I thought I might do is actually talk less about the credit crisis for a couple of reasons. One, because it's been done to death in many respects. And two, because you've just had morning tea and you probably would like to settle into that nice, cosy, warm spot after morning tea and think about those things later. But I'll certainly address risk and uncertainty because they're the drivers of not only fixed income markets, but everything else we do. What I'd encourage you to do today, is that a bit loud, is think, to be honest, think. I'm not going to give you any easy answers because I don't think there are any, but I'd really encourage you to think in much the same way as the paper talked quite a lot but didn't actually tell you what to do. So I'd like to pose a question to you, something to ponder as we go through the next 50 minutes or so. What if the investment advice that we give as an industry is not just generally wrong in a way that perhaps would allow it to be right sometimes or perhaps right in the long term, but what if it's wrong at such a deep, fundamental level that it might never in fact be correct? In much the same way as our Beijing official insists, despite the obvious, that the thick grey overhang in the sky is not in fact man-made but rather a wonder of nature. I'm going to frame the conversation today in terms of constancy, on those things that we believe or know to be true and those things that we can hang our hat on over time. So there are four components to today's discussion: education and experience, evidence and compulsion, the human paradox, and the risk-return trade-off. There are things in this world, and in particular the world of investments, that are constant, and we hope that we can count on education and experience. But increasingly we have found that the more we know, the more we learn, the less we know. So we'll jump into education and experience. There's a quite famous engineer and architect, Richard Buckminster. Buckminster Fuller, Bucky to his mates, and I'll refer to him as Bucky from now on because it's much easier, who's actually suggested towards the end of his life, he died in 83, that he has spent most of his life unlearning those things that have been proved not to be true. And I'd like you to keep that in your mind as we go forward. A quick analysis, a quick history, if you like, of the basis of most of our industry, not just fixed income, but the entire investment markets. That, as you know, is a normal distribution, and I'm sure you're all very familiar with it. So current market orthodoxy, which is based on this, actually began in 1900 when a Frenchman named Louis Bachelier suggested that price movements on the French bond market followed a normal probability distribution. So that implied that 68% of all price movements would be within one standard deviation, that 95% would be in two standard deviations, and 98% would be in three. Graphically represented, that's our familiar bell curve and one that we know and love. It has, of course, been known to accurately describe natural phenomena like IQ levels in a population, though I'm sure in this room it's slightly skewed to the right, and height in populations. But Louis proposed that this should also explain price movements in bond markets in addition to equity markets. And so in time, this model has actually underpinned the diversification strategy of modern portfolio theory. And we use it, of course, to build balanced portfolios of stocks and bonds. Managers use it to decide acquisition and disposal prices. They use it to decide how to hedge currency exposure, how to price and implement portfolio protection strategies, and, of course, how to perform any number of risk analysis on portfolios. And today, when we put together a portfolio, we use this normal distribution to calculate risk by first calculating relative probabilities and relative volatilities for every investment in a portfolio and how they relate together. And that calculation allows us, of course, to pull together investments in proportions that give us the right level of risk. And, you know, that can be called risk budgeting and portfolio optimization and all those sorts of things, but it's basically a comfort level that we derive from pulling things together. This distribution, of course, describes lots of small movements up and down within a prescribed range and very few big movements, and, of course, it implies independence of those movements. And while there are inadequacies of this mean variance models that we've all talked about, and, you know, there are additional analysis and research coming out that tinker with that model at the edge, we're still in large part stuck with this. Even so, and despite the tinkering, theory and practice in the investment industry is built on the understanding, but may lead to assessments of risk that are incorrect, and I would posit significantly so. And that worries me. So enough of the lesson, enough of the history. Let's assume that everything you believe to be true till now is actually incorrect, and we'll have a look at some of the more interesting stuff. I want to introduce you to Benoit Mandelbrot. Mr. Mandelbrot is the father of fractal geometry and a maverick mathematician, and I'd also posit a maverick stylist. I could actually find you a more current photo, but I really like that one because it, you know, just makes me feel a bit more attractive, to be honest. In his Fractal Geometry of Nature, which of course doesn't apply to investment theory or mathematics tremendously, he suggests that clouds are not spheres, mountains are not cones, coastlines are not circles, bark is not smooth, nor does lightning travel in a straight line. But he could just as easily have said that price movements are not random and return distributions are not normal. As we know, the price behaviour of markets can vary enormously, and there are frequent and significant departures from the expected, and here read, expected by a normal distribution. Indeed, there are a few very big and many very small and not very many medium-sized movements. So as a hobby, Mandelbrot applied fractal geometry theory to financial markets. And over a period of some 20 years, observing the Dow Jones Industrial Average, he decided to write a book called The Misbehaviour of Markets, A Fractal View of Risk and Risk, Ruin and Reward, which is a wonderful title. And he published that with a former editor of the Wall Street Journal in 2004. And it's kind of cool for a nerd like me. In that book, he suggests that bubbles are in fact inevitable and that they are at least in part the result of a human need to find patterns in the patternless. Now, both of these findings suggest that prices are not independent at all, and nor do they follow a normal distribution. That's huge when you think about the implications of that. That's not only huge because it changes the course of, could change the whole course of financial theory, but it's huge in terms of the implications on how we construct portfolios and how we view risk. And so while we've got a long way to go before fractal financial theory is in fact mainstream, I actually think there's great value in challenging accepted wisdom and in changing our perspective, if only for a while, just to see and pose the question, what if? So in line with that, I'd encourage you to think about this or him and the current market environments. And I'd like you to note the following observations that he made of the Dow Jones from 1916 to 2003. Under a normal distribution, given daily price movements over that time, we'd suggest that price movements of greater than 3.4% in any one day would be expected around 58 times. But in fact, we saw those over that period over 1,000 times. Indeed, we would expect a greater than 7% price movement in any one day around every 300,000 years, but we saw that 48 times. Clearly, there's some disconnect between theory and what we're observing in markets. Foreign exchange markets, are wild and wacky beings and are incredibly volatile. And you can see the same sort of observations come out of foreign exchange markets, in particular the US yen market. Note that between 86 and 2003, we all know that the dollar fell substantially, but nearly half of that decline occurred on 10 out of more than 4,500 days. That's quite extraordinary. In addition, during 87, the Dow Jones fell 22.6% in a single day. That's mathematically impossible, apparently. And I would like to have written, if you had invested on that day, to your broker and suggest that. We lived through the 80s. 40% of all positive returns from the S&P during that time came from just 10 days. And against this backdrop, of course, we'd suggest that the three standard deviation move is not, in fact, extraordinary at all, but rather quite normal. And if we look at more recent events, the jury's out on what is called the credit or the liquidity crisis, depending on who you talk to. And in fact, J.B. Weir at the beginning of this year suggested this could be, impossibly, a 17 standard deviation event. And that was the beginning of the year. I wonder what they'd be saying now. So this is actually not just a US phenomenon, though. If we have a look at what's occurred in the Australian market, I've taken this back to 1992, largely because that's where the data I could source the data from. It's daily price movements. Just to cast your mind back to 1992, I'll tell you what was going on there. We were, of course, just emerging from recession, and superannuation guarantee was just coming in. So there's a flood of capital that started to trickle into the market. At that time, interest rates were coming down from the late teens that were observed in the 80s and early 90s and had been just below 10% since 1991. Inflation peaked over that time at 15% in the third quarter of 2000. It was, of course, short-lived. The next quarter came in at only 1%. The AUD, the Aussie dollar, US dollar, was at all-time lows in 2001, just at the time that I was working in the States. And the Asian currency crisis hit in 1996, and we also saw in the middle of 1997 two quarters of deflation. Interestingly, over that last 16 and a half year period, we had 43 three standard deviation events. And what does a three standard deviation event mean to you and I? Well, it means that on any one day, we could either lose more than 2.5%, which is fairly significant, or gain more than 2.6%. Of course, the worst loss occurred this year, which might not surprise any of you. In January 22nd, we lost 7%, just over 7% in a single day, and that's an 8.2 standard deviation move. Our best gain, interestingly, was in our worst month, October 1997, and that was the 29th of October, where we gained just under 6% in one day. So if you think about, September, I've noted some of the big things that I think stick in people's minds. If you think about in a normal environment, where the normal distribution was born, you think about the height differentials between people, and you think about how often you see giants or dwarves. These three standard deviations are giants and dwarves in the market sense. And clearly, there are far more in the market than we would see on the street. Um, It's quite interesting, though, to change your perspective on this. We can see the market movements, the price movements, and we understand them. They're very familiar. We're comfortable. But if we change our perspective and look at this time series in terms of standard deviations, the story is actually quite or much more compelling. Just to talk you through this slide, the light blue band represents the outer limit of a 3-standard deviation move, and the darker blue band represents a 5-standard deviation move. Over this whole period, we've seen 43 3-standard deviation events, and that's on the, both the upside and the downside. And interestingly, in 2007 to date, and this was taken up to the end of last week, we've seen 27 of those 43 standard deviation events. So what's your frame of reference? I mean, how normal is normal anymore, given we're living through this environment? You'll note that the bull market, equity bull market of 2003 to 2006, actually reduced volatility, as you would expect and as you guys hopefully will recall. But the volatility started to increase in 2006, and of course 2007 was as it was. This graph, rather than the one before it, is the reason why we're finding the why I find the financial standard a difficult read, and in fact something that I like to read in the morning and certainly not before I go to bed. But we're talking about bonds today. So if we apply this analysis to the bond market, the story there is actually quite compelling. Again, 3-standard deviation events is the light blue shade, and the darker blue shade is the 5-standard deviation events. It may surprise you that while we've had, we've had some 70-odd 3-standard deviation events over that period, in contrast to the equity market that had, 48 standard deviation events. So by that measure, kind of scarily, the bond market actually looks much more risky than the equity market. From 1994 to 1996, that was our worst period in bond markets, and you'll recall interest rates were coming right down. We had 54 3-standard deviation events, but note, in 2007 to date, that volatility has been much reduced. In fact, we've had no 3-standard deviation events since 2004. Given the backdrop of the credit crisis, that's quite astounding, I think. Quite astounding. So on this, on this basis, bonds can be much more risky than equities, and certainly they're less predictable, I'd suggest, and the returns are less symmetric than in the equity market. So while we can see that it may be true that price moves are largely unpredictable, it's not true that they're mutually independent or randomly distributed, and I recall, I call your attention to the clumps of volatility, and that's probably more noticeable in the Aussie equity observations. Big price moves seem to beget other big price moves, and while smaller price moves seem to beget even smaller price moves, and you see that in the ebb and flow of volatility. But really, enough data, because that's the basis on which we build this, but it's far less interesting than the actual conversation. Evidence and compulsion. That is the tendency to take current observations and extrapolate them into the future. If you've read the paper that was submitted, you will have seen this graphic, but I'll just remind for those of you that haven't, this is a representation of market participant activity. The diagram maps the risk migration of investors in a very basic investor psychology. It's oversimplified, I think, which swings between reckless risk-taking and frightened risk aversion. Very simply, an investor observes that risk is underpriced, that is, that it's historically cheap, meaning there's less return for your risk buck. So you double up, leading to increasingly reckless risk-taking until that balance is called into question. That's where it really gets interesting. At that time, this thing can go two ways. We can either have a slow deflation of the bubble, and that would be an internal correction back to the prudence of the centre or beyond, or we can have through an external, an accelerated external shock, a massive swing. And on the upside, that could be via innovation or technology, and on the downside, that could be systemic shock. Obviously, the second of those two scenarios is a little bit more scary. Note also, and this is a little contentious, I think, the catalytic effect of regulators during the cycle of continual migration. Regulation so often fails simply because it's prescriptive and backward-looking rather than forward-looking. And in fact, one of my colleagues, who you can all throw something at later on, has suggested that perhaps, and I'm reading this now, regulation is hindsight and corporate governance is foresight, which I think is quite quite compelling. Let's have a look at this, but apply far more detail, and certainly more detail in light of recent events. I want to introduce you to another guy with crazy hair called Hyman Minsky. He developed or posited a financial instability hypothesis, which explains market instability as a result of the normal functioning of a capitalist economy. The diagram here shows, and again it's taken from the paper and explained more fully in the paper, the two extremes of financial operation. The first is stability on the right, which is marked by conservative risk-taking and debt activities with ample interest and principal repayment coverage. And second, the second market is instability, which is characterised by frenzied market behaviour and increasing use of debt to fund interest and principal liabilities. Minsky posited, that if we collectively spend too long in the stable phase, and I'd suggest perhaps we consider 2003 to 2005 as a stable phase. Remember, at that time, interest rates were fairly stable. We had modest or moderating inflation, slightly increasing growth, but still a relatively stable environment. That if you stay too long in the stable phase, investors gradually become less and less risk-averse. And you move from more conservative, risk-averse behaviour through speculation to frenzy. And in this world, frenzy is self-sustaining. Why? Because a borrower must borrow more to pay the interest they have outstanding, and indeed they may have to borrow more or sell assets to reduce the debt outstanding if, in fact, they can't do that. So that results in a fire sale of sorts. Against this, consider the recent balance sheet behaviour of financial intermediaries, whose role it is in some part to create, own and distribute risk. There, we've seen increased debt when assets rise, decreased debt when assets fall, which seems like it's managed to some kind of ideal target debt position. In this way, financial intermediaries have been seen to be quite pro-cyclical and actually magnify or potentially accelerate that cycle despite being ostensibly responsible for creating, owning and distributing risk. In fact, you could suggest under this scenario that they amplify it. So if we have a look at the level of risk or risk aversion in markets at the beginning of 2007, we can apply the theory and it kind of hopefully comes together for you. The graphs highlight risk appetite in equity and credit markets, so equity markets on the left, yes, and credit markets on the right. And the important thing here is to focus on trends rather than absolute levels, and in fact I suggest that's probably important across all that we do. Through the equity bull market of 2003 to 2006, risk aversion came right down. And you see on the equity market side the risk aversion coming down. Obviously it ticked up a little in January 2007. And at the same time, on the right-hand side, as indicated by the implied probability of default or price of default, the probability of default came right down. Obviously, the lesser risk aversion in equity markets was clearly mirrored in the credit markets and no doubt was some factor leading to the exuberance in credit markets and uptake of its instruments. So while the exceptional or exponential credit expansion of the last 5 years was fueled by seemingly insatiable risk appetite, innovation in securitization, structured products, and the use of synthetic instruments provided risk-seeking structures in an increasing supply to feed the market's expanding risk appetite. So what did this mean in markets? Well, I'd ask you to consider the growth of the complex structured product market. Think of the deals that came across your desk at that time. And I wonder, whatever happened to the tried and true maxim, a prudent investor shouldn't invest in something they don't understand? Which leads us quite nicely to the human paradox. We are, of course, all flawed. Well, no, we're not. Some of us are less flawed than others, I guess. The human paradox is, unfortunately, a desire to make sense of and apply order to chaos. And we can see that in the misbehaviour of the human psyche. I just cast your mind back to Minsky and his movement from instability to stability, and I'd also cast your mind back through the kind of equilibrium of prudence framework where you move from frightened risk aversion to speculative risk-taking. Unfortunately, markets deceive us, and we can't help but try to make sense of the madness. Excuse me. We therefore intuit patterns and trends where none exist, and we miss market trends. And of course, we're not alone in this. We are all in this together. Once we think we've sorted everything out, we seek validation and confirm this in the market noise that's presented. And while any number of pundits are willing to make sense of the market madness in front of us, the way a problem is or decision is framed is paramount. We uniformly entertain false comfort in fundamentals, but prices frequently and more frequently than not depart from fundamentals. And I wonder, have you ever asked six fundamental analysts what the value of a single company was? You usually get about 12 answers. Our version, therefore, of the mainstream or of normality is just as fleeting. And I'll spend only a very short time on this. There are a number of products here that we've seen, or products or ways to implement portfolio strategies that we've seen come to the fore and then perhaps sink back over the last 20-odd years. It seems that these products that appear to be the best thinking, the mainstream, the latest and greatest, come in ebbs and flows, much like the cycles of credit, the cycles of liquidity, business cycles and risk cycles in which they operate. A couple of things to think of. Perhaps passive management seems to be something that's getting a lot of attention at the moment. The assumptions on which passive management itself are based is that investment management is pretty much luck. It's very hard to pick good managers, and it's too hard to beat the market. So throw your lot in, reduce your costs, and at least then you can count on getting what the market gives you. Of course, this conviction, this assumption reverses in times of bear markets where there's a realization that investment managers can actually have skill and exhibit skill and, more importantly, beat the market. So I'd encourage you to think in terms of how these mainstream theories arise, what they're based on, and thereafter how they're tested and perhaps even fall away and crumble. In linking with Minsky and perhaps the search for the prudent equilibrium, this recycling is perpetual, of course. Now, I want to say a bit about bond managers. Bond managers are usually doomsayers. And frankly, why wouldn't they be? There's not a whole lot to lose if you are on the upside if you call a storm in fair weather, but there's an awful lot to lose if you call fair weather in front of a storm. And that's largely because growth is addictive. Growth follows liquidity in the form of money supply and debt. Consider the impact on superannuation fund flows and the historically very low cost of debt on markets at the moment. The corrosive power of success, as we have seen, and note also the law of diminishing returns as time goes on in boom times. At the same time as these things, growth is alluring and where our addiction is fed, at the same time as these things happen, there is a diminishing view of risk. Risk simply becomes less and less important. Due diligence there in that environment becomes checklist-driven rather than good governance, and I'd suggest that this is a fundamental problem. Although some of you may suggest that when things are going really well, why on earth would we bother sweating the small stuff? Well, I would ask you, how many bond reviews or bond manager reviews did you do over the last 5 years to 2007? At that time, I was an asset consultant. I can tell you I did less than I can count on one hand, which is quite scary but quite telling of where we are now. Reckless risk-taking is the result of this addiction to growth. And what follows the reckless risk-taking, of course, is the frightened risk aversion and, moreover, the destruction of conviction. So, these are fun things we've all lived through. Recall the late 1990s to the early noughties internet addiction. That is that any exposure to internet was bound to drive value in a holding despite not having earnings. Recall when that house of cards came tumbling down. But we've learnt, right? We have. How about then the commodity boom? And the commodity market has actually come off around 15% in the last month or so, despite BHP Rio Tinto still negotiating steel contract increases of 80 to 95%. Recall also the vast benefits of property stapling to shareholders, that is the benefits of incorporating management into the end investor. And I'd recall also that these were suggestions posited by Centro Westfield et al. So we are now at a stage where people are hanging in their hats on the fact that central banks are far more experienced than they have been in the past. And I just wonder if perhaps we're facing some false conviction there in their effectiveness, both in their ability to affect monetary policy, but also in their ability to bail out whole industries. And I'd ask you, have we really tested them at this point? Do we really believe that to be true? Or are we just clinging to the last bastion of growth, the last bastion of hope? Normality, myopia and amnesia. These are the things that we use, I think, as excuses in some senses. Five, excellent. All right, let me just say very quickly, normality is based on pretty much the last couple of weeks' data for most people. Our perception of normality is very much based on what we see today and what we want to believe. So a couple of weeks ago, or a month ago, the Aussie dollar hit 95, 96, and we're all talking vastly about parity with the US dollar. Of course, we're now talking about the Aussie dollar going back to 80. We're now sitting at 84, 85. Oil at $200 a barrel was, very convincing about 6 months ago, but now people are questioning it. And, of course, the trading range we can debate ad infinitum. But I would like to leave you with Dow Jones on July 19th, 2007, hit 14,000 for the first time. In August, the credit crisis hit. Risk and return. Here's where we get to the fun stuff about fixed interest. We all know that there's been vast evolution in fixed income markets over the last 10, 15 years. That's changed not only the structure, but the potential opportunities that we have available to us to invest. So what we consider now broad market, and that's evidenced by the core UBS composite that most managers use in Australia, moving into the extended market, so the hybrids, the emerging market debt and high yield, and into emerging opportunities. At the same time, our analysis of risk has actually moved from the practical consequences of those investments, so the fundamental, the downside risk involved, or the capital loss potential, to more the mathematical process. So if we have a look at the growth of government versus non-government holdings, and that's total outstanding, not the index, but certainly indicative of the type of ratios that we see in the index. At the same time, that the market's becoming more risky, so more increased exposure to credit, we've actually forgotten what risk is really about. So we've moved from what was an understanding of probability of loss that's intuitive and understandable to ourselves and our investors through absolute volatility, return, relative volatility, and Greek things that most people can't pronounce, let alone describe or understand how they affect a portfolio. That's a huge concern. So it's not surprising then that in 2007, if you go back to the beginning, there's not a whole bunch of people that could have suggested, that could have recognised what was to follow was actually in evidence in the market at that time. So if you read the newspapers at that time, you will have seen that the market pundits were heralding the rise of, you know, another wave. Everything was gung-ho, the life is wonderful. The environment itself, so that's not just the message, but the underlying data, looks pretty good too, to be honest. We just come off the back of a 25-year paper asset boom. There was plenty of money around, no liquidity crisis at all. Consumer confidence and spending was healthy. Unemployment was at all-time lows, and long-term yields were at historic lows, and that was a good thing. So at this point in time, beginning of 2007, you have a decision to make. You can either extrapolate and suggest that what's happening now will in fact continue into the future. That's not a bad decision. You can speculate and suggest that perhaps what's happening now won't happen into the future and suggest and invest accordingly. Or you can sit on the fence. And in this sense, I'd suggest sitting on the fence is actually hugging a benchmark. So what happened is kind of interesting. This shows real data. This is fund managers over the last 1 and 2 years. So that's to July. The UBS Composite is the red patterned mark there. And as you can see, managers chose, in some respects, to sit on the fence. So you hug the benchmark. Now, you can say that that's a manager problem, but it's also a problem, a function of discretion. I'd suggest perhaps the people further to the left extrapolated, suggested that what was happening in markets then, this massive boom, would actually continue, and the people on the right perhaps suggested that they would speculate and decide perhaps something else, some other paradigm would come through. Excellent. Okay. Risk, of course, is of fundamental importance. That same data is reflected here on the risk parameter. Note that higher returns were achieved with lower risk, which fundamentally goes to attack what we would consider the risk-return trade-off. So I've just thrown a whole lot of information at you, which I hope is leaving you confused. I hope it's leaving you confused because out of that confusion, I would trust, comes questioning and challenging of current orthodoxy, and that's a really great thing. So I've left this deliberately blank. This is the last one. I've left this deliberately blank because these are the sorts of, this is the framework in which you should put all of your investment decisions. So, role. Recall intention. What is the intention of either your bond portfolio or any of your portfolio allocations? For a bond portfolio, it might be as ballast to the broader portfolio. It might be as an equity market hedge. It could be an income generator. Then think about the objective, how you want this portfolio to perform, and be explicit. Talk about capital preservation, talk about capital growth. Understand that these are not necessarily mutually exclusive. And then think about facility. When you're choosing your managers, are you choosing managers that have the discretion to meet those roles and objectives? Discretion is actually misused quite often, but it's incredibly important because it's the thing that allows you to align interests of the portfolio behaviour and investor expectations. Is often used, very incorrectly, as a governance tool. That's not appropriate for the government's role. The government should actually come in and role an objective. It's really important for you to pick managers that have the ability to stray away from benchmark or to move to larger, you know, broader discretion where it's prudent and profitable, and to preserve the intent, so the role of that portfolio is incredibly important. You also have to pick a manager that's willing to go there, and that requires an appetite for conviction, and it requires the courage to go there when it may seem foolish to do so, when all your peers are going in the other direction. So I've not given you any answers, but that's precisely the point. Don't rely. I'd encourage you not to rely on accepted wisdom for tradition's sake, and do as Bucky did and try to at least unlearn those things that have been proved to be untrue over the past while. That, I just downloaded so much, I apologise. Happy to take questions, but I'm going to hand over to Cameron.
Claire is available now for questions, so she's she's on the hook for that. Look, we have given you a lot of information, and look, Claire's apologised for it. Don't really apologise for it. The intent of this is really about just getting everyone thinking about the way in which fixed income has actually been proposed to you. And you've been to other fixed income sessions today, or you know, in the past, that have actually said things completely contrary to what we're actually talking about here. And look, on that note, I expect probably one or two questions, and I'm happy to obviously open up the floor to questions for Claire on her presentation.
Okay, I'll kick one.
Jeff wants to kick off.
Yep. Coming into the close of your presentation.
Yeah, a couple of things there. I would encourage contrarian investing when it's prudent and profitable to do so, not for contrarian's sake. So that, you know, is an example you can use over the last year. Very clearly, managers that hugged index had difficult times, and managers that were able to step aside from that fared much better. I think the key to all of this, though, is to go back to this checklist. Make sure that you, as an advisor, clearly there's business risk, there's peer risk, you're in the papers, we all face that more commercial reality. But as advisors, you work very closely with your clients, and you should be thinking through the role, what's the intent of the portfolio, what's the objective, how it might behave, what you would expect to see. If you have, if you and your client actually understand that, if the advisor-client relationship is very clear on how that might perform, you actually remove the business risk, because that decision becomes a shared decision. You also remove the, you know, 8:45 phone call in the morning after someone's read the fin saying, my God, what do I do? The US dollar just dove last night. What's happening? Or the Dow killed itself. So I'd suggest that it's not a single decision, but it's a series of iterative decisions. And then you asked about the experience of managers. And I think there's obviously massive dispersion, not only on the risk front, but on the return front.
I guess, does Villanova as a manager of fixed interest?
Does Villanova as a manager of fixed interest securities have any sort of a view on whether we are at an inflection point after 20 odd years of disinflation, that we're going to move into a period of moderate inflation, and if so, for how long?
Yeah. Villanova are a thematic manager, and almost by definition, they can't have single point perspectives on things. Their perspective is that we're in the third out of four phases of what has been a massive turnaround, the deflationary environment. Their perspective is that we're nowhere near out of the woods yet, and in fact they've got very low exposure to credit and very low exposure to longer duration securities for that reason. They're taking a very risk-averse perspective at the moment because they simply don't think that the risk that's inherent in some of the other, albeit very cheap-looking securities at the moment, is worth it. And again, you know, bonds is a one-sided game. You can lose an awful lot, but you don't gain a whole bunch on the upside.
Other questions? Okay. Look, just to quickly tie this together too, Villanova, realistically, at the end of the day, what Claire's just summarised in the chart up here actually is very much about Villanova. It's about starting at a different point. This whole presentation really, I think, is giving you an introduction to actually the philosophy of Villanova. Because at the end of the day, we are about managing risk, but not from the point of view of that being a concluding point when you're actually starting, say, with a credit portfolio and you're trying to manage risk within it. Villanova looks at it from the very beginning and says, we want to eliminate risk. After all, that's what you invested into the bond market and fixed interest market for, was to eliminate and to manage risk and get compensated for that return that you're actually looking for within it. And you can see from the range of managers that sit there within the fixed interest area, there aren't many managers that actually have been able to, through these market conditions, actually manage risk very effectively. These guys, Villanova, start from eliminating risk. And that's where, as Claire's just highlighted, obviously, credit, it's a question of how Villanova actually currently view the credit market. But it's viewing the credit market from a point of view, if there's risk associated with the credit market, do we actually want to be involved with the credit market? If spreads are going to continue to blow, do we actually need to have money invested in it because there's capital at risk here? and they look at the capital preservation and getting returns from that. That leads just into two portfolios they run. They run a domestic portfolio, the strategic fixed interest portfolio, and a global domestic product called the Core Plus Fund. Sorry, question from the floor?
We'll both have a go at this. We might have different answers, though. clearly, as a headline rate, you'd be an idiot to go into bonds. That's the first perspective you look at. But then you start to drill down into that decision. And that headline rate is immediate as of today and subject to quite a significant degree of variability. And we've seen over the last month or so term deposit rates come down by 30, 40 basis points.
Obviously, the yield curve changed, and you get the blowout to 170 basis point returns within 1 month. And again, this month is tracking along the same sort of path. So if we end up with 300 basis points as a return in the past 2 months, that's a loss that a TD person's actually had or a cash person's actually had. I'll leave it at that.
No. Yeah, look, you know why you do? You hedge. You're hedging. You're taking the risk approach to the risk managing aspect of your portfolio. Term deposit rates will come down, and there's already speculation that that will happen. The beauty of having a bond manager in there that can actually make the decision to move up and down the yield curve is if, in fact, the investment decision is compelling at the cash area, they can move there. And that's actually what Villanova are positioned well into the down that end of the curve at the moment. But here's the thing. When rates come down, bond portfolios actually benefit from that. And so do you want to pay someone else, because it's a commercial decision, do you want to pay someone else to take that decision away from you to manage that risk? When should I jump between cash and bonds? Or do you want to take on that risk yourself? Now, if you're not comfortable with giving that risk decision away, the alternative is manage the hedge, so put some in term deposit, manage and put some in a bond portfolio, and you can actually optimise that, which I've told you is absolute rubbish, but you could. And you can make sure that the portfolio as a whole is actually quite well preserved from those falling term deposit type rates.
I'd probably also say, when you look at the headline information, which most of you would have seen as far as bond returns, you're looking at an index which is incorporated with credit. As Villanova as a manager can move away from the area of risk that they actually see is adding risk. And that's as a headline rate where, 150 points ahead as far as on a domestic and 300 ahead as far as the global fund as well. So you're talking a fund manager with the ability and the flexibility within its process to actually add value can also further enhance that decision to allocate or not allocate. I'll hand back over on that.
Thank you. Jeff Mitchell from Standard & Poor's is just now going to briefly explain to us or help us understand how this product type fits into a client portfolio.
Okay. Thanks. All that on risk. It's probably about another hour. But anyway, in bond portfolios or in the defensive component of your portfolios, Rumsfeld, there's known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. And what we've just been through is an unknown unknown. But with the benefit of hindsight, it's now a known known. Using this particular sort of product, we all know that you get rewarded for taking risk. That's the academic evidence that's built up, and it's largely irrefutable. So we are looking in the component of known knowns is cash and no risk, but we are looking for managers who actually can add value in the known unknown component. And that is exactly what comes back to your question is, what is the timing of this? What sectors should we be going after? In terms of a portfolio construction approach, we're looking for managers that can demonstrate that they're adding value for the risk. But that's not to say that we get an unknown unknown event, as we've just been through, that everybody's going to go the same way, because I think we're all fairly well aware that there's very few people that actually got out of this thing unscathed or saw it coming. I think everybody said, yeah, look, there's a bubble in credit. But the business risk was getting out too early. You look at the tech bubble, there's people calling an end to the tech bubble as early as 94. If they'd got out in 94, even after being in it in the crash, they still would have come out better off than having got out in 94. So we are constrained by our benchmark, and we're also constrained by what our clients perceive or what we educate our clients to be an appropriate benchmark or expectation around the asset class. So our view in portfolio construction is, again, choosing quality managers that have got range to do this. And the proof of the pudding is clearly in the eating, because the benchmarks have proven to be a pretty hard place to win ground in fixed interest in the last 12 months. Thank you.
All right, well, if you'd all just like to join me and thank Claire for a really insightful and thoughtful presentation, and Cameron and Jeff. We have one final thing to do, Gizmo. Let's have a look. Where is it? Okay, are we ready to go with our Gizmo session? Okay, would everybody like to? Are we going to have the 654? Okay. We're voting now? Okay, well, we're voting now. We just don't have the little ticker. We're finished? All right. Thank you very much, delegates, for coming along to our presentation.